వక్రతుండ మహాకాయ సూర్యకోటి సభప్రభా నిర్విఘ్నం కురు మే దేవ సర్వకార్యషు సర్వదా శివశక్త్యాయుక్తో యది భవతి శక్తః ప్రభవితుం న చేదేవం దేవో న ఖలు కుశలః స్పందితుమపి అతస్త్వామారాధ్యా హరిహర విరించాదిభిరపి ప్రణంతుం స్తోతుం వా కతమకృత పుణ్యః ప్రభవతి.
Sri Sai Ram. At the outset, my most loving and prayerful salutations at the divine lotus feet of our most beloved Bhagwan, Sri Satya Sai Baba. Dear listener, you are tuned to Radio Sai Global Harmony on Asia Stream, bringing you 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, the love and the message of Bhagwan, Sri Satya Sai Baba. Good morning. Greetings and loving Sai Ram on this Thursday on the 19th of March 2020, and with me Team Radio Sai, Sunil, welcoming you to this morning segment Divine Glory on Thursday Live from Prashantinilayam. Let me as always read out to you today's Sai Inspires message, and today's message is so relevant in the wake of the pandemic caused by the coronavirus. At times we experience losses, pain and suffering, despite our sincere spiritual practices. How should we reconcile and draw strength to continue our sadhana? Bhagwan guides us today, and I quote, "Whatever inconveniences one may encounter, one must try to carry on spiritual practices without any break or modification in the disciplines. Taking all worldly losses, suffering and worries as merely temporal and transitory, and realizing that all this repetition of the name and meditation is only to overcome such grief, the spiritual aspirant should keep the two things separate without mixing up the two. The spiritual aspirant must understand that loss and suffering and worry are external, belonging to this world, and that repetition of the name and meditation are internal, belonging to the realm of the love for the Lord. This is called chaste devotion or pativrata. At the specified time at least, recall to mind the meditation and repetition of the name done at the same time in the past, even if you are in a railway train, a bus or such inconvenient surrounding. In this way, accumulating spiritual wealth, one can surely become the master and attain the Atma." Unquote. This was taken from Prema Vahini, chapter 64. Dear listener, the time right now in our studios is 50 minutes past 9 a.m. That is Indian Standard Time. And today in Divine Glory, I've lined up for you readings from the English version of the holy book Sri Sai Satcharitra, written by Sri Hemant Pant, followed by the first part of a conversation with Dr. Sunil Menon, a medical officer serving at the Sri Satya Sai General Hospital here at Puttaparthi. But first, readings from Sri Sai Satcharitra. Sri Sai Satcharitra is an account on the life and teachings of Sai Baba of Shirdi, written by Sri Hemant Pant. We are thankful to Vasanthi Sundaram for reading out the contents from this holy book and to Veeramani Kannan for the melodious musical support. Wishing all a holy and blessed Thursday and a wonderful day ahead, and also praying to the Lord Almighty that the pandemic caused by the coronavirus be eradicated and all the suffering come to an end at the earliest. And from our end, let's all be very careful and be more cautious and stay safe. Samasta Loka Sukhino Bhavantu. Jai Sai Ram. And here it is for your listening pleasure.
The necessity of mendicancy. Now, to return to the question of mendicancy. A question may arise in the minds of some that if Baba was such a great person, God manifest, why should he have recourse to the begging bowl throughout his lifetime? This question may be considered and replied from two standpoints. Who are the fit persons who have a right to live by the begging bowl? Our Shastras say that those persons who, after getting rid or becoming free from the three main desires, progeny, wealth, fame, and accept sannyas, are the fit persons to live by the begging alms. They cannot make cooking arrangements and dine at their home. The duty of feeding them is laid on the shoulders of householders. Sai Baba was neither a householder nor vanaprastha. He was a celibate sannyasi, a sannyasi from boyhood. His firm conviction was that the universe was his home. He was the Lord Vasudeva, the supporter of the universe and the imperishable Brahma. So he had the full right to have recourse to the begging bowl. Now, from the standpoint of Panchasuna, five sins and the atonement, we all know that in order to prepare foodstuff and meals, the householders have to go through five actions or processes: Kandani, pounding; Peshani, grinding; Udakumbi, washing pots; Marjani, sweeping and cleaning; Chulli, lighting hearth. These processes involve destruction of a lot of small insects and creatures, and thus the householders incur an amount of sin. In order to atone for his sin, our Shastras prescribe six kinds of sacrifices: Brahma Yajna, Veda Dhyan, offerings to Brahman or the study of the Vedas; Pitri Yajna, offering to the ancestors; Dev Yajna, offering to the gods; and Bhuta Yajna, offering to the beings; and finally, Manushya Atithi Yajna, offering to men or uninvited guests. If these sacrifices enjoined by the Shastras are duly performed, the purification of their minds is effected, and this helps them to get knowledge and self-realization. Baba, in going from house to house, reminded the inmates of their sacred duty, and fortunate were the people who got the lesson at their home from Baba. Now to return to the other more interesting subject. Lord Krishna has said in the Bhagavad Gita, "Whosoever devoutly offers to me a leaf, a flower, or a fruit, or water, of that pure-hearted man, I accept that pious offering." In the case of Sai Baba, if a devotee intended really to offer anything to Sai Baba, and if he afterwards forgot to offer the same, Baba reminded him or his friend about the offering, and made him bring it to him, and then accepted it and blessed the devotee. A few instances are given below. Tarkhat family, father and son. Mr. Ramachandra Atmaram, alias Baba Saheb Tarkhat, formerly a Prarthana Samajist, was a staunch devotee of Sai Baba. His wife and son equally loved Baba, or perhaps more. It was once proposed that Master Tarkhat should go with his mother to Shirdi and spend his summer vacation there. But the son was unwilling to go, as he thought that in case he left his home in Bandra, the worship of Sai Baba in the house would not be properly attended, as his father, being a Prarthana Samajist, would not care to worship Sai Baba's picture. However, on his father's giving an assurance under oath that he would perform the worship exactly as his son was doing, the mother and son left for Shirdi on a Friday night. Next day, which was a Saturday, Mr. Tarkhat got up early, took his bath, and before proceeding with the puja, prostrated himself before the shrine and said, "Baba, I am going to perform the puja exactly as my son has been doing, but please let it not be a formal drill." Saying so, he performed the puja and offered a few pieces of lump sugar as naivedya. The sugar was distributed at the time of the lunch. That evening and next Sunday, everything went on well. The following Monday was a working day and it also passed well. Mr. Tarkat, who had never performed puja like this all his life, felt great confidence within himself that everything was passing on quite satisfactorily as per the promise given to his son. Next Tuesday, he performed the morning puja as usual and left for his work. Coming home at noon, he found there was no prasad to partake when the meal was served. He asked the servant cook, who told him there was no offering made that morning, and that he had completely forgotten to perform that part of the puja. At this, he left his seat and prostrated himself before the shrine, expressed his regret at the same time, chiding Baba for the want of guidance and making the whole affair a matter of mere drill. Then, he wrote a letter to his son, stating the facts and requested him to lay it at Baba's feet and ask his pardon for his neglect. This happened in Bandra on Tuesday noon. At about the same time, when the noon arti was about to commence in Shirdi, Baba said to Mrs. Tharkad, "Mother, I had been to your house in Bandra with a view to have something to eat. I found the door locked. I somehow got an entry and found to my regret that Bhav had left nothing to eat for me. So I have returned unappeased." The lady did not understand this. But the son, who was close, understood the whole thing, that there was something wrong with the puja in Bandra, and he therefore requested Baba to permit him to go home. Baba refused this, but allowed him to perform puja there. Then the son wrote a letter to his father, stating all that took place in Shirdi, and implored his father not to neglect the puja at home. Both these letters crossed each other and were delivered to the respective parties the next day. Is this not wonderful? Mrs. Tharkad. Let us now take up the case of Mrs. Tharkad herself. She offered three things: bharit, which was roasted brinjal mixed with curds and spice; karchia, circular pieces of brinjal fried in ghee; and perha, sweet meat ball. Let us see how Baba accepted these. Once Mr. Raghuveer Bhaskar Purandare of Bandra, a great devotee of Baba, started for Shirdi with family. Mrs. Tharkad went to Mrs. Purandare and gave her two brinjals and requested her to prepare bharit of one brinjal and kacharya of the other when she went to Shirdi, and she asked her to serve Baba with them. After reaching Shirdi, Mrs. Purandare went with a dish of bharit to the masjid when Baba was just sitting for meals. Baba found the bharit very tasty, so he distributed it to all and said he wanted kacharya now. A word was sent to Radha Krishnamai that Baba wanted kacharya. She was in a fix, as that was not the season of brinjals. How to get brinjals was a question. When inquiry was made as to who brought the bharit, it was found Mrs. Purandare was entrusted with the duty of serving kacharya. Everybody then came to know the significance of Baba's inquiry regarding kacharya and was wonderstruck at Baba's all-pervasive knowledge. In December 1915, one Govind Balaram Mankar wanted to go to Shirdi to perform the Shraddh ceremony of his father. Before he left, he came to see Mrs. Tharkad. Then, Mrs. Tharkad wanted to send something with him to Baba. She searched the whole house but found nothing except a pedha, which had already been offered as naivedya. The boy Govind was in mourning. Out of great devotion to Baba, she sent the pedha with him, hoping that Baba would accept and eat it. Govind went to Shirdi and saw Baba, but forgot to take the pedha with him. Baba simply waited. When again he went to Baba in the afternoon, he went empty-handed without the pedha. Baba could wait no longer and did ask him straight, "What did you bring for me?" "Nothing," was the reply. Baba asked him again. The same reply came forth again. Then Baba asked him the question, "Did not the mother give some sweet meat to you for me at the time of your starting?" The boy then remembered the whole thing. He felt abashed, asked Baba's pardon, ran to his lodging, bought the pedha and gave it to Baba. As soon as Baba got it in his hand, he put it into his mouth, gulped it down. Thus the devotion of Mrs. Tharkad was recognized and accepted. "As men believe in me, so do I accept them," was proved in this case. Baba fed sumptuously. How? Once Mrs. Tharkad was staying in a certain house in Shirdi. At noon, meals were ready and dishes were being served when a hungry dog turned up there and began to bark. Mrs. Sarkar got up at once, threw a piece of bread which the dog gulped with great relish. In the afternoon, when she went to the masjid and sat at some distance, Sai Baba said to her, "Mother, you have fed me sumptuously, famished my pranas. They have all been satisfied. Ever act like this, and this will stand you in good stead. Sitting in this masjid, I shall never, never speak untruth. Take pity on me like this. First give bread to the hungry and then eat yourself. Note this well." She could not understand at first the meaning of what Baba said. So she replied, "Baba, how could I feed you? I am myself dependent on others and take my food from them on payment." Then Baba replied, "Eating that lovely bread, I am heartily contented and I am still belching. The dog, which you saw before meals and to which you have given the piece of bread, is one with me. So also other creatures, cats, pigs, flies, cows, they are all one with me. I am roaming in their forms. He who sees me in all these creatures is my beloved. So abandon the sense of duality and distinction and serve me as you did today." Drinking these nectar-like words, she was moved. Her eyes were brimmed with tears, her throat was choked, and her joy knew no bounds. Moral: see God in all beings is a moral of this chapter. The Upanishads, the Gita, and the Bhagavad all exhort us to perceive God of divinity in all the creatures. By the instance given at the end of this chapter and other numerous to mention, Sai Baba has practically demonstrated to us how to put the Upanishad teachings into practice. In this way, Sai Baba stands as the best exponent or teacher of the Upanishad doctrines. Bow to Sri Sai. Peace be to all. Chapter 10. Sai Baba's mode of life, his sleeping plank, his stay in Shirdi, his teachings, his humility, Nanavali, the easiest path. Remember Sai Baba always with love, for he was ever engrossed in doing good to all and always abided in his self. To remember him only is to solve the riddle of life and death. This is the best and easiest of sadhanas, as it involves no expenditure. A little exertion here brings great rewards. So, as long as our senses are sound, we should, minute by minute, practice this sadhana. All other gods are illusory. Guru is the only God. If we believe in Sadguru's holy feet, he can change our fortune for the better. If we serve him sincerely, we get rid of our worldly afflictions. We need not study any philosophy like the Nyaya and the Mimamsa. As we trust the boatsman in crossing rivers and seas, so we have to trust our Sadguru in getting over the ocean of worldly existence. The Sadguru looks to the intense feeling and devotion of his devotees and endows them with knowledge and eternal bliss. In the last chapter, Baba's mendicancy and devotees' experiences and other subjects were dealt with. Let the readers now hear where and how Baba lived, how he slept, and how he taught. Baba's wonderful bedstead. Let us first see where and how Baba slept. Mr. Nana Sahib Dengli brought for Sai Baba a wooden plank about 4 arms in length and only a span in breadth for sleeping upon. Instead of keeping the plank on the floor and then sleeping on it, Baba tied it like a swing to the rafters of the masjid with old shreds or rags and commenced to sleep upon it. The rags were so thin and worn out that it was a wonder how they could bear or support the weight of the plank itself, leave alone the weight of Baba. But somehow or the other, it was Baba's sheer leela that the worn-out rags did sustain the plank along with the weight of Baba on it. On the 4 corners of this plank, Baba lighted panathis, or earthen lamps, one at each corner, and kept them burning the whole night. It was a sight for the gods to see Baba sitting or sleeping on this plank. It was a wonder to all how Baba got up and down the plank. Out of curiosity, many curious observers kept watching the process of mounting and dismounting, but no one succeeded. As crowds began to swell to detect this wonderful feat, Baba one day broke the plank into pieces and threw it away. Baba had all the 8 Mahasiddhis at his command. He neither practiced nor craved for them. They came to him naturally as a result of his spiritual perfection. Manifestation of Brahma. Though Sai Baba looked like a man, 3 cubits and a half in length, still he dwelt in the hearts of all. Inwardly he was unattached and indifferent, but outwardly he longed for mass welfare. Though inwardly an abode of peace, he looked outwardly restless. Inwardly he had the state of Brahma. Outwardly he seemed engrossed in the world. Sometimes he looked on all with affection, and at times he threw stones at them. Sometimes he scolded them, while at times he embraced them and was calm, composed, tolerant and well-balanced. He always abided and was engrossed in the self and was well-disposed towards his bhaktas. He always sat in one asana and never travelled. His satka was a small stick, which he always carried in his hand. He was calm and thought-free. He never cared for wealth and fame and lived on begging. Such a life he led. He always uttered Allah Malik. Entire and unbroken was his love for the bhaktas. He was a mine, storehouse for self-knowledge and full of divine bliss. Such was the divine form of Sai Baba, boundless, endless, undifferentiated. One principle which encompasses the whole universe, from a stone to Brahma, incarnated in Sai Baba. The really meritorious and fortunate people got this treasure grove in their hands, while those people who, not knowing the real worth of Sai Baba, took him to be a mere human being, were indeed unfortunate. His stay in Shirdi and probable birth date. No one knew or knows the parents and the exact date of birth of Sai Baba, but it can be approximately determined by his stay in Shirdi. Baba first came to Shirdi when he was a young lad of 16 and stayed there for 3 years. Then, all of a sudden, he disappeared for some time. After some time, he reappeared in the Nizam state near Aurangabad and again came to Shirdi with the marriage party of Chand Patil when he was about 20 years old. Then, he stayed in Shirdi for an unbroken period of 60 years, after which Baba took his Mahasamadhi in the year 1918. From this we can say the year of Baba's birth, approximately 1838 AD. Baba's mission and advice. Saint Ramdas flourished in the 17th century and fulfilled to a great extent his mission of protecting cows and Brahmins against the Yavanas. But within 2 centuries after him, the split between the 2 communities, the Hindus and the Muslims, widened up and Sai Baba came to bridge that gulf. His constant advice to all was to this effect: Ram, the god of the Hindus, and Rahim, the god of the Muslims, were one and the same. There was not the slightest difference between them. Then why should the devotees fall out and quarrel amongst themselves? You ignorant folk, join hands and bring both the communities together. Act sanely, and thus you will gain your object of national unity. It is not good to dispute and argue, so don't argue. Don't emulate others. Always consider your interest and welfare. The Lord will protect you. Yoga, sacrifice, penance and knowledge are all the means to attain God. If you do not succeed in this by any means, in vain is your birth. If anyone does any evil unto you, do not retaliate. If you can do anything, do some good unto others. This in short was Sai Baba's advice to all, and this will stand in good stead both in material and spiritual matters. Sai Baba as Sadguru. There are many so-called gurus who go from home to home with cymbals and veena in their hands and make a show of their spirituality. They blow mantras into the ears of their disciples and extract money from them. They profess to teach piety and religion to the disciples but are themselves impious and irreligious. Sai Baba never thought of making the least show of his birth. He had no body consciousness, but he had great love for his disciples. There are 2 kinds of gurus: niyat, who are appointed or fixed, and aniyat, unappointed or general. The latter, by their advice, develop the good qualities in us, purify our hearts and set us on the path of salvation, but contact with the former dispels our sense of dualities and establishes us in unity by making us realize Thou art that. There are various gurus imparting to us various kinds of worldly knowledge, but He who fixes in our nature and carries us beyond the ocean of worldly existence is the Sadguru. Sai Baba was such a Sadguru. His greatness is indescribable. If anybody went to take his darshan, he, without being asked, would give every detail of his past, present and the future. He saw divinity in all beings. Friends and foes were alike to him, disinterested and balanced. He obliged the evildoers as well as the pious. He was the same in prosperity and adversity. No doubt ever touched him. Though he acted through the body, he was not in the least attached to his body or the house. Though he looked embodied, he was really unembodied, free from gross existence. Blessed are the people of Shirdi who worshipped Sai as their god. While eating, drinking, working in their backyards and fields, and doing various household works, they always remembered Sai and sang his glory. They knew no other god except Sai. What to speak of the sweetness of the love of the women of Shirdi? They were quite ignorant, but their pure love inspired them to compose poems or songs in simple rustic language. Letters of learning they had none. Still, one can discern real poetry in the simple songs. It is not intelligence, but love that inspires real poetry. Real poetry is a manifestation of true love, and this can be seen and appreciated by intelligent listeners. Collection of these folk songs is desirable, and by Baba's wish, some fortunate devotee may undertake the task of compiling and publishing these folk songs either in the Sai Leela magazine or separately in a book. Baba's humility. Lord or Bhagwan is said to have six qualities: fame, wealth, non-attachment, knowledge, grandeur, and being liberal. Baba had all of these in him. He incarnated in flesh for the sake of bhaktas. Wonderful was his grace and kindness, for he drew the devotees to him, or how else one would have known him. For the sake of his bhaktas, Baba spoke such words the goddess of speech could not utter. Here is a specimen. Baba spoke very humbly as follows: Slave of slaves, I am your debtor. I am satisfied at your darshan. It is a great favor that I saw your feet. I consider myself blessed thereby. What a humility this is. Though outwardly Baba seemed to enjoy sense objects, he had not the least flavor in them, not even the consciousness of enjoying them. Though he ate, he had no taste, and though he saw, he never felt any interest in what he saw. Regarding passion, he was as perfect a celibate as Hanuman. He was not attached to anything. He was pure consciousness, the resting place of desire, anger, envy, and other feelings. In short, he was disinterested, free, and perfect. A striking instance may be cited in illustration of this statement. Nanavali. There was in Shirdi a very quaint and queer fellow by named Nanavali. He looked to Baba's work and affairs, and he once approached Baba, who was seated on his gaddi, and asked him to get up, as he wanted to occupy the same. Baba at once got up and left the seat, which he had occupied. After sitting there a while, Nanavali got up and asked Baba to resume his seat. Baba sat down, and Nanavali fell at his feet. Baba did not show the slightest displeasure in being dictated or ousted. This Nanavali loved Baba so much that he breathed his last on the 13th day of Baba's Mahasamadhi. The easiest path, hearing the stories of the saints and being in their company. Though Sai Baba acted outwardly like an ordinary man, his actions showed extraordinary wisdom and skill. Whatever he did was done for the good of his devotees. He never prescribed any asana, regulation of breathing, or any rites to his bhaktas, nor did he blow any mantra into their ears. He told them to leave off all cleverness and always remember Sai, Sai. If you did that, he said, all your shackles will be removed and you would be free. Sitting through five fires, sacrifices, chantings, eightfold yoga are possible for the Brahmins only, but they are of no use to the other classes. The function of the mind is to think. It cannot remain without thinking for a minute. If you give it a sense object, it will think about it. If you give it a guru, it will think about the guru. You have heard most attentively the grandeur of Sai. This is a natural remembrance of Sai. Hearing the stories of the saints is not so difficult as the other sadhanas mentioned above. They remove all fear of this sansar and take you onto the spiritual path. So listen to these stories, meditate on them and assimilate them. You may do or attend to your worldly duties, but give your mind to Sai and his stories, and then he's sure to bless you. This is the easiest path. But why do not all take to it? The reason is that, without God's grace, we do not get the desire to listen to the stories of saints. With God's grace, everything is smooth and easy. Hearing the stories of the saints is, in a way, keeping their company. The importance of the company of the saints is very great. It removes our body consciousness and egoism, destroys completely the chain of our birth and death, cuts all the knots of the mind and takes us to God, who is pure consciousness. It certainly increases our non-attachment to sense objects and makes us quite indifferent to pleasure and to pain, and leads us onward to the spiritual path. If you have no other sadhana such as uttering God's name, worship or devotion, but if you take refuge in them wholeheartedly, the saints will carry you across the ocean of worldly existence. It is for this reason that the saints manifest themselves in this world. Even sacred rivers such as the Ganges, Godavari, Krishna and Kaveri, which wash away the sins of the world, desire that the saints should come to them for a bath and purify them. Such is the grandeur of the saint. It is on account of the store of merit in past births that we have attained the feet of Sai Baba. We conclude this chapter with meditation on Sai's form. He, the graceful and handsome Sai, standing on the edge of the masjid and distributing udi to each and every bhakta with a view to his welfare. He who thinks the world is an illusion and who is ever engrossed in supreme bliss, before him we humbly prostrate ourselves. Bow to Sri Sai. Peace be to all.
Satguru Sai Baba.
Shaka Padmandhava.
Sister Sai.
Spend the day with Sai. From 6 a.m. to 9:30 p.m.
on Radio Sai's Thursday Live.
Radio Sai Thursday Live.
Stay tuned.
Dear listeners, Sai Ram, we now bring you a special conversation with Dr. Sunil Menon. This is a two-part interview and today we will be listening to its first part. In conversation with Dr. Sunil Menon is Radio Sai's Karuna Munshi and this interview was recorded in our studio on 14th October 2016. Have a listen please.
Sai Ram, dear listeners, and welcome to a special conversation. The topic of discussion today is integrative medicine or holistic health, and my guest is especially qualified to enlighten us on this topic. His name is Dr. Sunil Menon, MD, and Dr. Sunil Menon is the head of the Department of General Medicine at the Sri Satyasai General Hospital in Prashanthi Nilayam. By way of his academic background, I am pleased to inform you that Dr. Menon completed his MD in respiratory medicine from the Mumbai University. He went on to specialize in allergy and environmental medicine with AAEM in the United States under Dr. Bill Ray, a pioneer on the subject. He continued his further training in nutritional medicine with various experts in the field while in the United Kingdom. Presently, he works as the head of the department in Swami's General Hospital right here in Prashanthi Nilayam. And currently, he continues to be associated with doctors in the United States who practice a new field called functional medicine, which takes a holistic approach to disease management. He is very interested in introducing some of his principles to the patients who attend General Hospital. And these principles include yoga. So, keeping Swami's teachings in mind, we thought it was an ideal time for us to bring our listeners up to speed on this very concept of functional medicine, which takes this holistic approach to disease management. On that very happy note, I am glad to welcome Dr. Sunil Menon to Radio Sai. Sai Ram, sir.
Sai Ram, thank you very much. It's a privilege to be here and share some of my thoughts on the subject and whatever little bit I know. Thank you.
And we are truly honored to have you. We have so much to learn from you. Now, we noticed, Dr. Menon, that there is a need to shift the healthcare paradigm, and this is becoming public discourse, not only in India, but also in the United States, in the United Kingdom, parts of Europe. What can you tell us about it?
Well, science always has needed something new to happen if things don't work. So for a long time, doctors have been realizing Western medicine, as we call it, conventional medicine, as we call it, has been very successful in acute care. And the technology has boomed, and the pharmaceutical companies have their share in it. And health has become an industry to save patients. And it has been quite successful. If you're caught in the right time, you're close to a good hospital, and you have the facilities, including the fact whether you can afford all that. Yeah. Acute care medicine is actually doing very well.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trained in conventional medicine and, you know, I'm trained in to give acute care. And in the general hospital, you know, most of the patients who do come in an acute state of need or help, we do help them. The problem is, statistics show that chronic disease is increasing. And our healthcare approach is not really, really an answer to chronic disease. What they call as non-communicable diseases is on the increase. For example, diabetes, which was about 15th on the list in India, has now jumped up to number 6 position.
Hmm.
And they say by 2050, it'll be number 2 or number 3.
Oh, alarming.
The other thing they noticed was that 80% of chronic diseases are diet and lifestyle mediated.
Tough one.
And if it is diet and lifestyle, they should be preventable.
Yes.
And all over the world, they are worried.
What percentage did you say? 60?
80%.
80%. So it's not your DNA you can blame.
Nope. No, unfortunately, only 25% of the conditions can be blamed on the DNA. The rest is environment and diet. That's the shocking thing they realize now. You're not born or prone to diabetes. You may have the gene somewhere in your body hanging about, but you become diabetic because of your diet and your lifestyle.
And that's very unfortunate what you said about diabetes in India.
Yeah.
So we are leading such poor lifestyle, making poor lifestyle choices. And
true.
Our diet choices that we are going up the list.
True.
So what exactly is the difference between acute and chronic illness?
Well, basically, I'll talk about the approach. You know,
yes.
In an acute illness, why modern medicine works is because we are taught to deal with a patient's complaint. We are taught to investigate the patient. We are taught to do some tests. And then we reach a conclusion of what to give. And in most of the conditions that come to us in an acute state, there are protocols to deal with it. Unfortunately, if you use the same methodology in a chronic illness, say for example, a diabetic, there are multifactorial things that's happening in the patient. All diabetics are not the same. Unfortunately, again, Western medicine treats everybody the same. And they got the same protocol. And that doesn't work because individual prescription is now being demanded by the condition of the patient. And we find where did the patient come from, what lifestyle did the patient lead, and what led to the diabetes may have different factors which need to be addressed. For example, in a particular case, it may be just diet. In another case, it may be genes. In a third case, it may be the general lifestyle. And the fourth case, it may be stress. If you know what is really precipitating the diabetes, the same formula doesn't work. So a patient should be assessed in such a way that we take all these factors into account. The problem is today's doctors don't have the time for that. It takes quite a bit of investment by the doctor to do this, and it takes a lot of investment by the patient to participate in his or her health. Modern science and modern technology and the way we are brought up, we want the doctor to fix the problem. Most of my patients who come to my room and sit in front of me, they've got a lot of issues, but they don't want to discuss that. They come with a problem and they say, "Doctor, you fix it for me." They don't even want to participate in the fixing. They feel the injection or the drug or the tablet will do the job. They go back to their diet and lifestyle. Nothing changes. And we find that pharmaceutical companies are inventing new medicines every year. But the progress of disease all over the world has continued.
That seems so incoherent.
True. There is a subject which come up in the functional medicine group. They call it the 21st century medicine. And they say that their approach is so radically different. They say if a chair has got four legs, one leg is the diet, the second leg is the lifestyle, the third leg is the nutrients and whether they exercise or not. And surprisingly, the fourth leg is yoga, meditation and spirituality.
Really?
And that is what pulled me into this group of people who seem to reflect what Swami was saying.
Exactly. Swami is the pioneer of this stream of medicine and all medicines, of course.
True. And maybe it's the right time for human beings to wake up and realize the Annamaya Kosha is what the doctors are dealing with till now.
Which is the outermost sheath of the human personality.
And we have forgotten about the Manomaya Kosha and the Pranamaya Kosha totally. these people are now realized that you cannot just treat the Annamaya Kosha with drugs. You need to bring the other koshas into the picture.
So what can you tell us, or how can you educate us to understand the need to treat ourselves as a conglomerate of all these koshas or the various layers or sheets that make the human personality?
Well, to start with the first kosha, the Annamaya Kosha, it's made of Anna, food. That's where the diet comes in.
Okay.
And invariably the exercise is part of it. And diet just doesn't consist of food. When we talk about diet, we are talking about nutrients. And we must ask ourselves a question that what has changed? Everybody eats food. Why should some people fall sick and not get the nutrients? For that, historically speaking, we must look at what was the human being's diet thousands of years ago. They lived very close to nature. And there is a strong connection between what you eat and what you breathe and where you live to how your genes and how your body performs. For example, Eskimos, they eat a lot of blubber and fish oil and fish. They hardly eat vegetables and grains. If you look at the Eskimo diet, you know, it can't be followed by any other culture. But their genes have adjusted to the environment. They hand over that to their children. If you take the same Eskimo and modernize him and give him an American diet, within 10 years, they all get diabetes and hypertension.
But they don't have diabetes up in the North Pole.
No. They don't even have heart attacks.
So the body has just adapted.
And what has happened today is that we have forgotten that our genes play a part. We inherit our lifestyle and diet habits, which is why perhaps, historically speaking, we had caste systems, because each caste had its own environment, own lifestyle and own diet habits.
And vocation.
And all of them matched with what they did and what they ate. They had a separate set of vibrations. Today what has happened is two things have happened. One is that we don't live our lives close to nature. For example, our hormones are related to sunlight. So when you wake up, your hormones kick start, and then throughout the day it plays its part. By 7 o'clock it starts shutting down.
Mm-hmm.
If you live in artificial light, this doesn't happen. And the sleep hormone called melatonin requires darkness.
Yes.
But if you watch TV or if you're sitting in front of a computer, you are messing with the melatonin. Your body gets confused. You say the light is still coming in, so I should be awake. So what it does is it produces cortisol to keep you awake. And cortisol, unfortunately, suppresses further melatonin. So your whole hormonal cycle is disturbed. You don't get good sleep. When you wake up next morning, to kickstart, you take a coffee with a lot of sugar.
Yes.
And invariably that gives you initial energy, but it is messing with the natural cycle. It can go on when you're young, but after the age of 45, this starts breaking down.
But even amongst youngsters in the IT industry who work on American time zones in India in call centers, this is a huge problem. Because they are exposed to artificial light all night and they have a very disrupted sleep cycle.
True. So now the research is showing that some people adapt. The person who comes to the doctor is the one who is not adapted. So we are generally dealing with people who are not adapted.
Mm-hmm.
And the numbers are increasing. That is the danger. You see, if the numbers remained at, say, what, 1 in 100 or 1 in 1,000, we wouldn't worry so much.
Mm-hmm.
But the numbers are increasing so much that now we are realizing the human body is adapted since millions of years. For a gene to change, it takes a million years.
Wow, so many generations.
Exactly. So maybe in the next million years, you know, we may have human beings who are different than us. At the present moment, we are not winning the battle at all. And the costs are going up. It's not affordable for a person to really, really look after health. Health has become expensive. It has become an industry. When actually it shouldn't. You know, it should be preventive and it should be lifestyle choices and diet. So what these functional medicine, integrative medicine and holistic medicine people have found out, that if you actually take that individual and give them advice to change their lifestyle, to change their diet and become as organic as possible. And the problem now is the processing of foods. The micronutrients are not available. and the soil has been so enriched with fertilizers and artificial means and pesticides that the chemistry has changed. So what you see as food on the table is not the real great-grandmother's food on the table. And the wheat and the grains have also been modified. GMO foods have come.
Mm.
And they found that the nutritional value really doesn't exist. So cleverly what the companies do is they add some rubbish and say that this is fortified.
Hmm.
But it's not natural.
I see.
And the human body is so clever that it can make the difference. That, oh, this is not coming. For example, if you take magnesium, as an example, as a mineral that's missing in 80% of our diet now, we fortify with magnesium oxide, which is the cheapest compound available.
In a multivitamin tablet.
Multivitamin tablet.
Yes.
That's the worst chemical that the body can take because magnesium oxide is not absorbed.
I see.
The body doesn't like it, in other words. It's not biological. So what the body does is throw it out.
Uh-huh.
So we giving supplements in this chemical fashion has not really matched our lifestyle.
What is a natural source of magnesium?
Well, the fact is they don't have a natural source from fruits and vegetables, but if you want some, you really want to get lots of it, then you have to eat nuts and seeds. Out of which the cheapest available in Parthi is pumpkin seeds, which are melon seeds, which they throw away. All they have to do is just, you know, dry it, roast it and eat it.
Peanuts also?
Peanuts, yes, certain amount. But if you want the kind of high quality magnesium which our body needs as a replacement, it's found in green leafy vegetables a lot. But then you have to eat at least 4 servings of it, which many people don't. The vegetables are just floating about. So the quantity matters, which is the problem. Really, the, you know, whole family sharing, you know, a dish, the amount of vegetable going to as a serving to a person is very much reduced. And the other big issue now is with oil. Oil has come up as one of the biggest issues that
we are bombarded with advertisements that confuse us which is the right oil. What is your take on it, doctor?
Well, the research now shows that fat has been mentioned to be one of the biggest toxins, and we said that saturated fat should never be eaten and we should all go into polyunsaturated fat and all that rubbish till now. And we believed it. And the real culprit is sugar. So sugar is the one that is the killer today. Sugar in the sense that doesn't include sugar by itself. It includes all our refined flour
and
polished rice. That breaks down to sugar. It's equivalent to sugar.
I see.
So our body doesn't differentiate. So if you eat polished rice, a cupful of polished rice is equivalent to, you know, 6 spoons of sugar.
Oh dear.
So, in the past, that wasn't the case. We used food that wasn't refined at all. And the oil we used was cold-pressed. And it was either cold-pressed or extracted, you know, by just squeezing it between, you know, a grinder in the local village.
Yes.
And it was brought home and you cook with it and you don't use it for, you know, a month or 2 months. We take the amount we need and then we crush it again. And that is biologically alive. And it's got all the ingredients. The other problem is refined oil is omega-6. It's a highly inflammatory oil. And omega-6 is not very good. It's good for the body for certain jobs. What we need is omega-3. Omega-3 is unfortunately not very well absorbed unless in vegetarian diets. It's mainly found in fish oil.
Fish oil, yeah.
And we have to eat a lot of flaxseed to get a lot of omega-3.
Yes.
When you refine oil, all the omega-3 is disappeared.
Oh. Yeah.
And mustard oil is another choice which has got quite a bit of omega-3. Coconut oil has got some.
What about ghee? Because Ayurveda says organic ghee is very good.
Exactly. So now they are saying that provided the cow is eating grass,
yes,
and it's your own cow and you're lovingly, you know, looking after it.
Hmm.
If you mix milk from 20 cows and then produce ghee out of it, that's a problem. So the source is the issue now, and it's become a problem all over the world. When you say organic, how organic is it? Can we go back to that level of manufacturing? No easy answer. But if you want clear your health issues, you have no choice. You have to really, really get out of the system, allow the body to repair itself. Then maybe you'll tolerate a little bit of, you know, the processed food.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the kind of patients that come to us where the damage is so severe that they feel a drug can rectify it. Unfortunately, in chronic illness, it doesn't do the job.
Mm. When you say processed food, what exactly do you mean? I can't think of too many things that I buy off the shelf which has not gone through some process.
Yeah. The ideal thing would be, you know, the apple should come straight from a tree without pesticides on it. if the banana is being artificially ripened while it is being transported from Africa or wherever, the process is interfered with. It's the processing. If you pasteurize milk and then you mix milk and put it in a plastic container and sell it after 2 weeks, that is processed food. But if you actually take milk from a cow next to you, or in the olden days, the cow used to be brought and the milking was done in front of you. So it is straight from there to the boiling and you drink it. And that's the end of the story. So processing is now part of our lifestyle. But by heavy processing, I mean chemicals. For example, refined oil comes to you without odor, golden colored, mm-hmm. you know, looking so nice, with a high boiling point, is processed through a lot of chemical processes, which destroys the original organic oil.
And you know, it took me so many years to realize that there is no grain called canola. When I was buying canola oil, it is CAN comes from Canada and Ola is oil, and it's just a genetically modified grain.
True. The tragedy is they don't sort of tell us about all these things. If you look at the fact that where is sugar present? It's present everywhere. Whether you use a ketchup or a sauce or buy bread.
Yes.
So sugar is one of the hidden culprits. And now the research shows that sugar is the one that causes what is known as insulin resistance. And we have replaced carbohydrate in our diet. So if you compare diet 10,000 years ago, the amount of grains they used wasn't that much. Mm-hmm. And then when it became very cheap and available to everybody and it became a good source of, you know, calories, people started replacing normal food with a lot of grain. And originally, grain was there as an extra bit on the plate. Mm. But today, it's a lot of grain and a little bit of chutney and
everything else around it.
Around it.
They're fixins.
And we have become a carbohydrate-based population.
True.
And our human body has got 20 feet of intestine to digest meals. And why is there such a long intestine there? It shows that it's expected food to be really broken down gradually. And we are supposed to eat what is known as complex carbohydrates. Carbohydrates in its original form. Today, because of modification, the grain has got less of the fiber and more of the carbs. Which is good because you get more energy out of it. Unfortunately, in a sugar format.
Mm-hmm. Now, many of our listeners, for example, are either vegetarian or are leaning towards vegetarianism, and there is always this confusion regarding the protein requirement for a healthy body. What is your advice to vegetarians when it comes to seeking out good sources of protein, and how much?
I think that's an excellent question because we don't have an easy answer to that. Poverty and malnutrition go together. If you're undernourished, you know, it goes together. So the replacement of good protein from varied sources is the answer. So if you eat a lot of different lentils and mix it with a lot of legumes and then eat a lot of nuts and seeds, then a vegetarian is fine. But if you look at the expense of feeding a whole family like that, is the problem. There is no really, really easy answer to compensate for the fact that a vegetarian needs a varied format of protein intake, because the essential amino acids are not present in every grain or seed or lentil or legume.
Ragi is supposed to be
so
rich.
Yes. So one thing is the unfortunate thing in vegetarian food, one particular source cannot cover for all the sources. So you need what is known as a balanced mix of different protein sources. So if you take urad dal along with moong dal, along with groundnuts and other legumes like broad beans or narrow beans, then there is a mix along with ragi. That's good.
And along with seeds and nuts.
Now in the past, eating seeds and nuts was rather standard in every family. All grandmothers had a little tin of various seeds and nuts, including my grandfather. She used to have different formats. I find even jackfruit seeds were roasted and eaten in Kerala. And it's not just the jackfruit itself is eaten. Almonds were eaten, cashew nuts were eaten. It was all available, and it was part of our culture to eat different seeds. Unfortunately, what has happened is we have become partly westernized. And then we have gone into what is known as convenience foods. So, and these convenience foods are not really nutrient dense, as you call it. You know?
They're just calorie dense.
Calorie dense. But that's become, you know, a habit of people to, you know, have a chai and then go for the wrong food. Yeah. Nobody eats chai and peanuts or chai and seeds or chai and,
you
know, nuts.
Yeah, you want samosa or a budgie or something fried.
Exactly.
Deep fried. Twice, if preferably.
So, invariably, the nutrient content is zero and the calorie is very high. And nutrition is a very poorly taught subject in schools, and most of the parents who come to me, they have a little idea of, you know, you're feeding the wrong things to a growing child. They also believe that milk compensates for a lot of nutrition.
What are your thoughts on that?
Well, actually, you know, human beings are the only animals on the planet drinking some other animal's milk. We have adapted, but unfortunately about 60% of human beings are milk intolerant. Only the people in France, Scandinavia, and certain few countries have milk tolerant. India in some parts. But generally, we are milk intolerant.
Is it a genetic issue?
It is, most probably.
I think people are not that conscious about lactose intolerance in India.
True. We don't diagnose it because the symptoms are different in different individuals. And the other thing is, the type of milk has changed. The original milk, it's called A2 milk, comes from the original cow, which ate grass.
Mm.
All over the world now, we got the hybrid milk, because the hybrid cows, it's called A1 milk. And they found A1 milk is highly allergic and very intolerant. And many patients, when they switch to, you know, a desi cow, as they call it, they tolerate the milk. They digest it better.
Wow.
So, there are a lot of factors that is involved.
Yeah. It's like Devonshire cream, which is supposed to be the best, but those cows eat specific kind of grass only.
Exactly.
It reflects in the taste of the milk and its purity.
Yeah. The fact is, omega-3 is available from the grass. Modern cows, the way they make milk is they feed them grain.
Yes.
And
sometimes even
and cows don't eat grain. Cows don't eat grass.
It's not their natural food.
Natural food. And invariably, you know, they fatten them up quite a bit. That's mainly for the meat industry. But the milk is spoiled. So milk, and they get a lot of antibiotics and,
And hormones.
They get a lot of hormones. And invariably, they're messing with, that's what I call processing. Processing doesn't just end in a box. Processing starts with the animal itself.
Hmm.
And it's a subject which people are aware of. And they are going organic, but the industry is in charge. So invariably, they rule the roost. They control what people eat.
And they inundate us with messages through advertising and completely brainwash us.
True. The tragedy, the other problem really is that people tend to believe what somebody else says. And when they come to a nutritional approach, they're quite surprised that nobody talks in that language. So invariably they are suspicious that, oh, nobody told us about this till now. Why are you bringing this subject all of a sudden? But common sense actually works. I'll tell you a simple story I read the other day. I think it came in the Deccan Chronicle. And I was surprised to read that article. There is this tribe somewhere in Assam living very close to the forest. They were leading a very traditional life. Nothing processed. Everything they made was made right there. Most of the forest produce actually fed them. Unfortunate thing was they were not modern. They were not educated. So the government went and said, you don't have much cash with you. You're living like tribals. You're not coming into the modern world. So they wanted to modernize them. So in order to help them, they said, let's grow some cash crops, as they call it. And they built, they deforested the place, and they forested it with cash-growing crops like eucalyptus and, you know, teak and all sorts of things. To end the story, basically the forest died. So these guys didn't have anything to eat. So the government said, don't worry, we'll supply you with sugar and
rice and more sugar.
More sugar,
yes.
and flour and rice at cheap rates and our refined oil. And the elders didn't like it very much, but they had no choice. After 10 years, they noticed that their children were falling ill. And then a dietary team went to check, I think a medical team went to check the standard of health of these people and found it had gone down. There was malnourishment, there was undernourishment, there was all sorts of health problems which was never existed.
So much for the civilized approach to living.
In 10 years.
Yes.
Now, these people then protested. Actually, the ladies, the elderly ladies, they said, we want all of us to go back to our original diet, give back our forest. So they abandoned that site and went to a separate forest area and let the original site grow back. And when they shifted their area of living and their diet and lifestyle, everything improved by itself.
My God, amazing.
And this is...
And within a span of what, 2 decades?
2 decades.
My God.
And that whole article came up and written by a nutritionist. And I was surprised to read it in Deccan Chronicle, which shows that it's not that we don't know the subject. We know that if human beings shift to what we call as modern diet, and if it doesn't have the nutrients in it, the body will react.
Hmm.
You put the body back into its original habitat, in its original environment, and the original diet. Nature takes care of itself. God has made the body so beautifully. It's got a self-healing process. You have to be intelligent enough to help that self-healing process. And you go into either cure or reversal or remission without drugs.
Hmm. Now, this you were talking about the different koshas or the layers or sheets that make up a person. This is at a physical level. What comes next?
Well, now the latest research shows what is really killing a large percentage of modern individuals is stress. And we think stress as something bionic or something very serious or something which comes with a jolt from the sky.
Mm-hmm.
Not at all. The state of happiness of your mind, the way you live life, the way your achievements and, you know, your attitudes are, is contributing to stress. So what is happening today is a lot of unrealistic expectations. And when these unrealistic expectations hit you very slowly, we think that there is no stress. The person pretends to jog through life with a smiling face. They also sort of tend to feel they are actually winning the whole equation. But the body is very clever. However you put that smiley face for society's sake, internally, the mind knows. And what it produces is a hormone called cortisol. Now, cortisol has been created by nature for acute stress. And that is the fight or flight phenomenon.
Hmm.
So when there's an acute problem, you know, 10,000 years ago, problems were either acute, which they had to deal with, and you dealt with it.
Like a tiger attacking me in a forest.
So, even if there is a crisis, you know, usually you find that the crisis is solved with a philosophical look at it. It is not that it should be solved. They look at it in a philosophical manner. Today, you know, it's an instant gratification society. They want it to be done. If the bus is a little late, they get angry. So, you know, if you're stuck in a traffic jam, you lose your mind. So, we are in a society where stress reaction seems to be normal.
Mm-hmm.
So, we don't even bother if that reaction is seen.
Unacceptable. To throw a fit, to use foul language, or to fling your arms and get upset.
And invariably, that raises your cortisol.
I see.
And that is a very bad hormone to increase.
And I'm sure it's a slew of other chain reactions that happen.
That
your blood pressure goes up, you're hyperventilating.
Your blood sugar goes up. And the biggest unfortunate thing is we've got two brains. One is the primitive brain, the reptilian brain, which is required for our emotional reaction and all our emotions. And then we got the cortex, the frontal cortex, which is the brain where the logic and the analysis comes in. Most of the time our reptilian brain is switched on and our reaction is at that level. If we are not practiced, what we need is allow our superior brain to take over. And how to switch is the question. Because we are in stress morning till evening and we are decision making and we need quick decisions. So what happens is the instant reaction comes in. So we don't reflect.
Mm-hmm.
Because we don't have time to reflect is one of the things they say all the time. And cortisol, you know, kickstarts the reptilian brain. And invariably, you know, once it does that, you lose control. And whatever we say, whatever comes out of our mouth, is controlled by the reptilian brain. It's a reactive brain.
And then we can regret over it for the rest of our lives, but the words have escaped.
And how do we train the superior brain, the superior cortex? Well, by meditation.
Hmm.
So what they found is that if you want your manomaya kosha to really, really work, and there is a a machine that can measure what is known as, it's called a heart rate variable measurement.
Mm-hmm.
And the machine can measure that. If your heart rate variable has got a very smooth pattern, because the heart rate keeps varying, and the machine, it's not beat to beat, it's not the same. So this machine can monitor it. If it comes in a very smooth fashion, that means invariably your cortisol level is normal and you're generally calm and you're okay. If it is all over the place, it means, although you may not be showing it externally, mm-hmm. but your heart knows, it shows. So you meditate. And they found that, and this is done in the UK, and if you meditate, your heart rate changes. Immediately it calms down.
So what do you mean by meditate? Is it silent sitting, guided meditation, vipassana?
It is basically something that suits you. And there are techniques where you just sit in your office and control your breathing.
Mm-hmm.
And just watch your breath.
Mm.
And you do it at intervals of, 5 to 10 and stop it. And then after an hour or so, do another 5 to 10.
Mm-hmm.
That's good enough to correct your heart rate.
It's like
variation.
A reset button.
So it's a reset button. So you just stop everything
mm-hmm.
and close your eyes and just watch your breath. Now that is the quickest way I've read about with effects. And which anybody can do.
Mm-hmm.
But if you talk about, the prolonged format of meditation, mm-hmm. which certainly has got more spiritual connotations to it,
mm-hmm.
and a large percentage of people perhaps wouldn't want to go into that area when they're leading a normal life. If they want to do that, that's fine. If they got time to do it, that's fine.
But amongst, in the 9-point code of conduct, Swami said we should do Jyoti meditation every day.
Absolutely. So,
if we follow it, we won't have much of this issue of overreacting and falling into the stress trap.
Absolutely. Hmm. You see, it's health hygiene.
Well said.
So, we have to look at the mind hygiene also.
Yes.
So, whether you watch television and you have to be in a conference or whether you have to be in a meeting, you're absorbing all negative energy anyway. Without you knowing, your hormones are going all over the place. How do we switch it off? And you have to have a health hygiene of doing that, and the manomaya kosha is taken care of.
So, going further or deeper into this, past the manomaya kosha, what can you teach us?
Well, what they have found in research is, it is not just enough looking after your physical and looking after your mental. You must have a spiritual background. Now, they use the word spiritual, unlike using the word religious.
Religion, yeah.
Because that causes a lot of conflict in your
yes.
mind.
I wonder why, though. What's the big deal? But yeah, in an age of political correctness, they prefer to use the spiritual.
And then what they found was, what is the biggest problem today that is affecting the Western world, which is perhaps coming here? Isolation and loneliness.
Hmm.
So they didn't know what that was all about. They're giving all the physical comforts. They're giving an old people's home all the coins required by an old person. They're putting the old person in front of a television. Didn't work. And the states of dementia and Alzheimer's, most of these patients got worse in such a situation. So nutritionally they were all right. And as far as comforts were there, they were all right. Medically they were looked after by doctors. Loneliness and isolation causes lack of love.
Hmm.
And what they discovered was, by just hugging these people, by just putting them into what is known as hugging groups,
mm-hmm.
where strangers went them and sat with them, just held their hands for 10 minutes, need not be their relatives at all, somebody else. It was done silently. It was not done by talk, because talk wasn't required. Just the transference of love perked these people up. So they found that if you're not really spiritual in the kind of, inverted commas kind of bracket, what was the essence of life was love. And they said, you don't have to be religious, you don't have to be spiritual, but love we can always give. And this was very surprising for them, because in the Western culture, they didn't know the effect of it. Now, in the Indian context, the joint family always had this bonding. There was always a spinster aunt or a widowed aunt or a grandmother who we used to run to. And I know my younger days where there was always this particular person who had a lot of time for us. So if all the other elders are busy, or they will send us to this person, they say, you go to this person. And that person will be calmly sitting down, smiling away, and be with us. what was being transferred was nothing intellectual, no advice.
Mm-hmm.
It was just the transfer of, I am there for you.
Mm-hmm.
And that factor is what we basically call spirituality. We are now put a lot of other definitions to it. But the easiest definition, which I think matches with Swami's words all along, start the day with love, spend the day with love, and end the day with love. What is that all about?
And embodiments of love.
Exactly. And he tells doctors too, he said that don't spend, you know, time writing prescriptions. Spend time talking to the patient. He said, I would prefer you talk 20 minutes to the patient and write the prescription in a minute or so, instead of the other way around. So basically, this is the fourth leg of the stool, which I talked about, or the chair. You know, you do the nutrition, you do the diet, you do the lifestyle, you do the exercise, yoga, you do the meditation. If you miss the love factor, it doesn't work. And this is a surprising thing integrative medicine found, because they never thought holistically the love factor was so important, that if you are positive, and the love can come in many forms. And we have found that among patients. Patients who are very innocent and positive, they recover faster. We find our village patient who comes from, you know, the distant villages from Parthi. They come to our hospital. They have absolute faith in Swami. They have absolute faith in the doctor. They have absolute faith in everything.
Thank God. They're not cynical.
Nope.
As the city educated, who have read up on Wikipedia and come.
Exactly. And sometimes we don't know how they recover, you know, and
I think the buy-in is complete.
Exactly. And invariably, it's not our effort. We just don't know that why this patient is waking up and then eating idlis next morning. Who is curing? And if you say that the doctor is curing, I think that is very, very small way of looking at it. In the big picture, what is curing is this patient is full of positivity. And the patient's faith is 100%. There's no doubt in the patient's mind, which we can't transfer with words, we can't transfer with an injection, we can't transfer with a tablet. It is an attitudinal thing, and which should start right from the gate, you see. The moment they enter, the transference of love should start right from the gate. It should transfer to the nurse, it should transfer to the doctor, and to the treatment. And integrative medicine has jumped onto it and realized that if you have all the factors and no love, which is what is happening in modern corporate hospitals, where you get an air-conditioned room, where the consultant comes in, talks to you for a couple of seconds, you get a big bill at the end of the day, and they feel you should be cured.
And you're right, absolutely. I can completely relate to what you're saying. Now, integrative medicine seems like the answer to the problems of healthcare of our times. How is it being received, this outlook, this vision being received by conventional medical schools? Because I noticed some in the US, like Duke and a few others, they were spending quite a bit of their budget and their time on integrative medicine, whereas others are not up to speed.
The sad thing is, it is a health industry.
Yes, everything is an industry at the end of the day.
And it's controlled by the pharmaceutical companies.
Who want their pills to sell.
And invariably, it's like processed food. Coca-Cola wants everybody to drink Coca-Cola. And you know that, you know, it's such a strong acid that you can wash your toilet bowl with it. So invariably, they found that for any scientific change to occur, attitudinal change to occur, it takes a lot of time. Human beings don't switch very quickly. And in the medical field, it takes more time than necessary. The famous story is the Samwell story of Germany, where he was a gynecologist, obstetrician in the early 1910. And in those days, the doctors never washed their hands. They used to go from patient to patient, delivering baby to baby, without washing their hands. And they used to just wipe it on their you know, apron. It was a big privilege for them not to wash hands. And they found the mothers were getting infected with something known as puerperal fever. And he introduced a simple thing. And he said, in those days they didn't have these kind of antiseptics. So he used a very, very strong liquid of bleach. And he told all his doctors, his junior doctors and himself, he said, we'll all wash our hands before going to the next patient. And the infection rate fell. It was practically as high as 40 per 100. it fell to 2 per 100. But it took 75 years for that idea to catch on.
To become protocol.
Yeah, protocol. So, people still didn't wash.
But with IT revolution, you know, grandmothers using WhatsApp, hasn't the pace of adapting quickened, in your opinion?
Adapting in the sense that we have superficially picked up more tools to decrease, the labor of work. But in the process, we have lost a lot of our brain tissue because the brain cannot continue its sharpness unless you use it. They found that if after the age of 65, you take up a new profession and a new study, you don't get Alzheimer's.
That's right. I've been reading that. Do you concur with that?
Oh, absolutely. It's because whatever we talk about aging is because of a misuse and disuse of things. And invariably, all these tools is not adapting. We are learning shortcuts to make our body not work. And nature doesn't work that way because our human biology took a million years to develop. Within a span of 100 years, we are technologically, gone into space and gone all these magic things. In the process, we have ignored the fact that our human being itself is not meant to live like this. We are not meant to live with 24-hour light and 24-hour telephones
and stimulations
and computers and TV. We may adapt in another million years, who knows. But the present generation is breaking apart and the idea of living life like that is an artificial idea the Western world has brought in. They seem to presume that nature is not important. They have isolated man from nature entirely. They also found that, night shift workers get more cancers. So now night shift jobs, if you take, your insurance doesn't cover you much in the West if you're a night worker because they know you may get cancer. So all things are working against us. So we should draw a line. How far can we play with nature? I'm not saying that technology should stop or we shouldn't use, but we must draw a line somewhere.
Dr. Menon, I read somewhere that consumption of pure cold-pressed coconut oil is helpful for preventing dementia and even reversing some amount of Alzheimer's. Is there any scientific basis for that?
Yeah, there is a lot of research, not on all of them, because each person's Alzheimer's is different. Why they came to that conclusion is because it has got a kind of fatty acid.
Medium chain fatty.
That the brain can use.
I see.
And brain, what they call this is type 3 diabetes. You see, the brains in these people, they develop a diabetes called type 3, where the sugar cannot be used. So they call it a type 3 diabetes. Basically, the brains don't function on sugar. And invariably, they got high sugar levels, they got insulin resistance. And the shortcut to that was if the brain cell has to get energy, it uses this type of fatty acid.
May I ask a few personal questions? What kind of oil do you use, Dr. Menon, at home?
Well, after coming here, obviously abroad it was easy for me, but after coming here, the oil we use ghee as far as possible.
I see.
And the second thing is coconut oil is what we use. So olive oil is expensive, that's a problem. And people can't afford it. I would say that if you've got cold pressed oil, even if it's mustard oil, and if you genetically, if you belong to West Bengal, they used mustard oil for ages. And mustard oil has got high levels of omega-3.
In Kashmir also, the traditional oil is mustard oil. Because that's what grows there.
Absolutely. So basically, coconut oil they researched on because the American pediatrician who treated her husband who had Alzheimer's tried this oil. She did her own research on, medium chain triglycerides and found it's useful for the brain. They found which oil has a lot of it. She found coconut oil has a lot of it. And she's the first one who introduced the subject, and then it went into research.
Yes.
And that's how it came up. So coconut oil came accidentally as being a good oil. It has been used in Kerala for centuries. But,
yes.
But unfortunately, if you refine it, that's the end of it. So
cold pressed.
It has to be cold pressed.
I see. And do you use a microwave?
I have one. Emergency, yes.
Okay.
But regularly, no. Not recommended. I see. Really.
And what are your sources of protein in your diet?
Well, that is one of the major issues that are coming up. And the only way we can compensate is introducing soya, provided all forms of soya are not good. And ladies shouldn't eat a lot of soya.
Yes. What is the threshold?
That is the problem. It differs from person to person. So you see, nutritional science has got a big handicap now. that we can't measure. At least in India we can't. Abroad what they do is they feed you with a certain format of diet. Then they measure what are the levels of your cholesterol, what are the levels of your HDL, LDL, where is your sugar going, what are your hormones are doing. And they say, oh, okay, how are you feeling? And they say, this diet suits you. Certain people, they can't eat and switch to certain diets. Unfortunately here, you know, we don't have that science. Mm-hmm. We have to sort of go traditionally by asking, what do you generally eat traditionally in your house? Like Brahmins who are vegetarians, where did they get the protein from?
Mm.
Mainly it was dairy, and mainly it was from, you know, grains and pulses and seeds and nuts. So we had to go that route. Remember, protein is present in everything.
Mm-hmm.
It's present even in vegetables.
Mm-hmm.
So we have a wrong idea that protein is found only in meat and whatnot.
Yeah.
That is a wrong
and
concept.
And tofu has protein.
Tofu is very good, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Now, the benefits of integrative medicine in today's age and day, especially in the West where big universities are investing money in it, is it to some extent measurable?
Oh, yes. What they've done is integrative medicine in the past belonged to a series of isolated doctors.
Right.
And most of them didn't have evidence-based, scientific analysis done.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this group of people are now getting referred to by the Western medicine and conventional doctors because they're failing in their treatment. And the success rates are now being reported, published. There's a series called Betrayal Series, and I would like all my listeners to go to this series called Betrayal Series.
Okay.
It's a set of videos, free, online, and I don't know how long it'll be available, but if they go to that series, they will get the latest info.
Is it on YouTube or?
It's if you just go into betrayalseries.com,
okay.
They'll
B-E-T-R-A-Y-A-L.
Give you a link.
Betrayal,
yeah, Betrayal Series. It's a betrayal because, and I would like to add here that the gut has been ignored by conventional medicine. And the gut has got bacteria living in it. And God has given us some extremely good bacteria that should be living there.
Mm-hmm.
This science is a very, very baby science now. Now the reports are coming in that if your gut is not happy, if the bacteria in there are not happy, and if the bad ones come there, it affects the whole system. So they call it the microbiome.
Mm-hmm.
And a large percentage of patients have got very unhealthy microbiome. This has been discovered. And if you correct the microbiome by your diet lifestyle and giving, you know, probiotics and other things, your symptoms disappear.
I see. Yogurt has natural probiotics.
Yes. Yogurt has got one type of the bacillus required.
What are the other sources of good probiotics?
Well, if you actually eat fermented foods, you know, in traditionally...
Like miso and all?
In Indian tradition, pickles. Fermental foods and fermentation of foods and pickling was a common thing.
Yeah.
You know, we used to pickle everything. And all these things have different forms of... gut bacteria.
I'm so happy to meet a doctor who endorses pickles. Thank you, Dr. Menon.
Yes.
We've been told to stay away from, you know, spicy food, hot food. Yes. Good
well,
to know.
The spiciness is another issue. Basically, I'm talking about pickling in a format it doesn't cause gastritis.
Hmm.
But today, you know, we find more of the spiciness and things have come in. But if you really look at fermented foods, they fermented for a long time. Most of the pickles that you use, they have been fermenting in the oil juice of
yes.
the thing. And the chili bit nowadays has gone up quite a bit. So
in Japanese food, miso and kombucha.
Miso and kombucha.
Kombucha, both are fermented.
Yeah, so in every culture had. Every culture had. If you look at every culture, they found it by trial and error. You see, most of the human beings have been living on this planet. And traditionally, grandmothers were handing out recipes.
Mm.
They were sort of helping health. And traditionally, the tribals and the ancients knew that if we eat like this, everybody's happy and healthy. We are going the other way around. And today, you know, the manufacturing process. See, a manufactured jam is different from the jam my grandmother used to make.
Mm.
She had a peculiar way of making the jam. And while making it, a large percentage of bacteria and things used to get involved in it, which we thought was unhygienic. Today we realize that walking barefoot is a good thing to do. So our hygiene hypothesis has now failed. If you're too hygienic, then your immune system cannot recognize the good
exactly.
and bad. And we need the germs. God has made them. They are not in nature as our enemies.
Mm.
80% to 90% of them are very healthy germs.
Mm.
It's only 10% that are naughty. And we need the 80 of them. But what we're doing is we're destroying all of them.
Mm.
And our way of looking at the human body is very odd. We feel that if you, you know, destroy the germs who are protecting us, you're very hygienic and clean. No.
You should see young mothers are constantly wiping the floors and their children's hands and actually rendering their children very poor in their immunity.
Swami himself said that walk barefoot.
Yeah.
And, you know, he says things which has got very deep meanings.
And he himself walked barefooted.
Exactly. And he says that how will you get the immunity? You know? So, even cesarean sections are causing problems. They would prefer that the baby is born normally. Because while the baby is born, the baby gets all the bacteria, the flora, which is going to actually go into the gut and produce the first set of the bacteria in the gut. And breastfeeding also does that. And invariably, cesarean sections, they found, is causing babies to become extremely allergic and prone to ill health. So the trick they're doing now is they wipe the baby's face with a swab that is taking the mother's secretions.
Hmm.
So science is going round and round saying if nature knows best, you leave everything as natural as possible. You don't have to really, you know, jump over the wall. If you really lead a life where nature intended and or know how to switch off and know how to, you know, allow nature to do this kind of healing once in a while, you know, you can do a cyclic system of I'll fast on, you know, 2 days a week or 1 day a week. On certain days I will eat only these kind of foods. So if you give body a chance to recover and you are mentally happy and, you know, you're very positive, you don't need to, you know, see a doctor at all. And you must get the love and support too. So it's not just, you know, quick fix. Our whole social fundamental attitude of why we are here on earth and what we doing here, what is the purpose of our life, comes into the picture. Unfortunately, you know, we are all target oriented and we all got deadlines. And we feel that a person reaches 20, a deadline should be hit. Person reaches 30, another deadline should be hit. We are living very artificial lives. Does it affect health? Well, it's obvious it is. $4.3 trillion is the budget of the economy in the United States, projected for 2023. $4.3 trillion is quite a huge amount without the success being there. So building more super hospitals and more having more cardiac surgeons doing more interventional cardiac surgery is not the answer, because how many can afford that? What about the rest of the population? Mm. They will be ignored. So we need a preventive approach, not for the rich, not for the poor, for humanity itself, to realize that, you know, let's work with nature instead of isolating ourselves from it.
Well, Dr. Menon, this has been quite an eye-opening session just listening to you and learning from you. But I still have a whole lot of questions to ask of you, including all these things that we hear about cleansing, emotional cleansing, spiritual detox, physical detox. I want to know about how much exercise and what sort of exercise we need on a regular basis. We hear all kinds of different formulae, 30 minutes, 5 times a week minimum. And does it have to be something related to aerobics or weights? How important is all that? And there are many other topics that we need enlightenment on. But I guess for today we'll pause right here. I just want to take this opportunity to thank you very, very much for sharing your insights and your wisdom with us.
Thank you, Sairam. It was a pleasure.
Sairam, sir.
You just heard a special conversation with Dr. Sunil Menon. In conversation with him was Radio Sai's Karuna Munshi. And this interview was recorded in our studio on 14th October 2016. This was a two-part interview and today you listen to its first part. Next week at the same time, you can listen to its second part. Dear listeners, as always, your feedback is very valuable to us. Please send us your comments and suggestions on this program by writing to listener@radiosai.org. Thank you and loving Sairam from Prashanthi Nilayam.